Rice.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 8th. We have three cases on for argument and two non-argument cases today. I will note for the record that Judge Connolly is recused from this case. The first case, Judge Bond will be subbing in on that, and she will be watching the arguments and will be conferencing later. So with that, I will call the first case, which is A24-1402, State of Minnesota versus Kirk Oxendine. And counsel, please let me know if I'm saying that incorrectly.
That's the correct pronunciation, Your Honor.
Thank you. And counsel, when you're ready, please make sure you state your name for the record because we are recording this, and you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can everybody hear me okay with this mic?
Yes.
Okay. I don't even think I need it, but I'm assuming it's being.
I think it's probably more for the.
Yeah.
Our audio recordings.
I project. May it please the court. My name is Chang Lau. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant Kirk Oxendine. In my brief, I raised two issues for this court to consider. Today, I would like to address the second argument involving judicial bias first before discussing my sufficiency argument. In State versus Dorsey, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that, quote, an impartial trial, requires that conclusions reached by the trier of fact be based upon the facts and evidence and prohibits the trier of fact from reaching conclusions based on evidence sought or obtained beyond that adduced in court. Mr. Oxendine was charged with felony violation of a domestic abuse no contact order, or DANCO. In finding him guilty of that crime, the judge who presided over Mr. Oxendine's court trial expressly relied on the fact that she had issued a DANCO against Mr. Oxendine at a bail hearing, and that the terms of that DANCO were explained to him on the record.
Let me ask something. You think that the judge could ever sit on a case where they issued a DANCO in which a DANCO has been issued?
I do think so, Your Honor.
Okay, and under what circumstances would that be?
Well, under Dorsey, having the knowledge itself does not disqualify you as a judge. I think it's the reliance or the use of that information that disqualifies you. And so that's the discussion in Lopez about when a judge becomes an impartial trier of fact and morphs into an emergent trier of fact that evinces emergent bias.
So in this case, what did the judge rely on, in your opinion, that would have made a difference in the outcome?
Well, again, to sort of parse that question out, Your Honor, first and foremost, the error here that we've identified is the use of the knowledge that DANCO was issued at a bail hearing and the terms of it explained in order to determine an essential element of the offense. Now, with regards to the question about prejudice, the Dorsey and Lopez are fairly clear that so long as emergent bias exists, so long as you would prove that emergent bias sort of pervaded the case here, then prejudice need not be shown. Reversal is automatic.
So if she wouldn't have said anything, you wouldn't have any problem with, if she hadn't put anything in the order, you wouldn't have any problem with what occurred.
Well, I would still take issue if she had relied on that information. We just wouldn't have been able to discover that fact, right? But the fact that she put it in her order, which rendered the verdict.
But how does a judge ever rid themselves of that knowledge once they have it? And
well, I mean, I think the case law is fairly clear that, say, in a situation where you are the judge that presides, is presiding over a felony DWI case where it's a felony because there's a prior enhancement, or excuse me, a prior conviction that enhances the DWI from a misdemeanor to a felony. Now, as a trier of fact, you're expected to disregard your knowledge of that prior felony DWI, even though you know that it exists, until the state is able to prove it at trial. And so that's, had the state produced evidence that this Danko was issued at a bail hearing on August 27, 2022, or 2021, I can't remember the exact year, and the terms of that, the Danko, were explained to him, and the court relied on that fact, and I have no gripe with the use of that information in
the trial. Didn't the state prove that there was a Danko? I mean, that was...
Well, I wouldn't say
that's part of the record, wasn't it?
Proved it. I would say the element at issue that the court used that information to find is that the defendant knew about the Danko, and there was evidence that a jail administrator, an assistant jail administrator, had served that Danko to my client, and that was the only evidence that my client was aware of that Danko. But in addition to that, the court used her personal knowledge that the Danko was issued at a bail hearing, in addition to the fact that the terms were explained to him on the record, to find that that element that my client knew about the Danko existed.
But wasn't there other evidence that he was served with a Danko in the record?
Yeah, by the jail administrator, correct, Your Honor. And again,
so didn't that show the knowledge, or at least that it was delivered to him and he knew or should have known?
Sure, but again, I would argue that that fact goes to prejudice, right? The question, I think, at the outset is whether or not emergent bias has been shown. And under Dorsey, so long as a fact finder relies on information that's not presented at trial, they are not providing the defendant with a fair trial. And so if we're able to determine that, which the state concedes the court relied on that information to prove to an essential element of the offense, the state concedes that. And so the second question then is prejudice in a typical case. But as Dorsey and Lopez provide, if we're able to show emergent bias, it's structural error. The reversal is then automatic. It's fairly straightforward on that piece of it.
But the bias, you're arguing more than just emergent bias, right? There's first emergent bias that you're arguing, and which my understanding is that the fact finder is no longer neutral.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and so there's that, but then you're also arguing, even if it's not emergent bias, the judge was still biased and we should reverse.
Well, so there are three categories of bias that Justice Chudich identified in Lopez. The first is actual bias. We are not arguing actual bias. The second is emergent bias, which we are arguing and we just discussed. The third is the appearance of bias, which is also included in our brief. And we argue that certainly the use of extra record knowledge in order to find that the state had proven an essential element of the offense gives an appearance of bias to not just the defendant, the parties, but the public at large. And so the three Powell factors ask this court to consider whether there was prejudice. I mean, in the Powell analysis, then there is a consideration of prejudice. And our argument is that looking at those three factors under Powell, we would still prevail, even if this court did not find that emergent bias existed.
So even though the fact in the record that he was served with the Danko exists, which then proves the knowledge element, arguably, you still think the judge's statement that there was a Danko issued at his bail hearing is problematic?
Under the emergent bias analysis or the appearance of bias analysis?
Let's start with the emergent bias analysis.
I do think there is a problem. I think Dorsey is fairly clear that so long as there's the use of extrajudicial knowledge, if that knowledge is not extra record knowledge, if that knowledge is not set aside, then defendants are deprived of a fair trial. I think the exact language from that court is an impartial trial requires that conclusions reached by the trier of fact be based upon the facts and evidence, right? And if the court is relying on the fact that the Danko was issued at a pretrial bail hearing and explained on the record to my client to find that he knew about the Danko, and that those facts were not part of the state's case, were not presented at the trial, then my client is deprived of a fair trial, right? That undermines all of the proceedings. So that is why we argue that emergent bias exists and that prejudice need not be considered. Now, under the, I think under the Powell test, this court looks at the three factors, the prejudice to the defendant, the possibility of prejudice to future defendants, and sort of the public reputation question about whether or not viewing this, the public would lose faith in the judiciary. And we argue that all three factors sort of are met in this case. I think the weakest, of course, and I'll concede this, is the first factor. Of course, Powell and the cases that follow, they say that not all three factors need to be met in order for this court to overturn a conviction. But that factor, I think, is still in play because, as we discussed, Judge Smith and I earlier, there was only one piece of evidence that went to show that my client was aware of the Danko, just that he was served by the jail administrator. Now, I'm not saying that that alone couldn't have proven the knowledge, but the fact that the court the district court felt the need to supplement that information in order to find that element existed is indicative of the fact that the district court judge itself felt there wasn't enough information there to support that element. And so it had to bulk it up with that extra record knowledge in order to determine that it had been proven. And so in that way, I do think that there's evidence that use of this extra record knowledge prejudiced my client. Now, as far as future prejudice, again, I think the discussion that I had at the start of this argument with Judge Smith is relevant because, yes, there is going to be this notion from district court judges that I certainly can rely on this information that I gathered in the course of these Danko proceedings because it's so matter of fact, right? It's an immutable fact. It's part of an official record. And even though it proves an essential element of the offense, that we can use it. And so if nothing is done here, my fear is that district court judges will continue to do this. And I do think that it is clearly impermissible. You cannot use extra record knowledge, say a prior felony DWI or some prior fact, to prove an essential element of the offense in the case that you're presiding over as a district court judge. That is problematic. And to allow that to continue, I think, would not just potentially prejudice future defendants, but it would tarnish the reputation of the court.
If we agree with you on the emergent bias, your relief would be a new trial?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
On both, under both analyses, our request for relief is a new trial. I just want to touch briefly on the first issue that I raised as to whether or not the direct evidence that the state presented at trial was sufficient to establish that at the time of the alleged contact with the complainant, there was an existing Danko against my client. So to sort of start things off, I'd just like to identify the two pieces of evidence that the state relied on at trial and that the state relies on here on appeal to prove that element, or to show that element was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The first is that the Danko that was allegedly violated was issued 4 months before the contact between my client and the alleged victim. The second is that the complainant at trial testified that she called the police when my client purportedly contacted her indirectly because he had a restriction violation order. Now, with regards to that first piece, I mean, I don't think we have any argument that a dango was not issued against our client, prohibiting him from having contact with the complainant. But in the dango, it very clearly provides that that dango expires upon the resolution of the case. Now, the state did not provide any evidence to show that that dango still existed at the time of contact outside of those two pieces of evidence I just provided. Now, with regards to the testimony that the complainant provided that she called the police because my client had a restriction violation order. As I point out in my brief, there is no such order, no restrictive order in the state of Minnesota with that name. Now, earlier in her testimony and her direct testimony, she discussed a danko with the prosecutor. So she knew what a danko was and what to call it. But she didn't when the prosecutor asked her, why did you call the police when this contact occurred? She said that there was a restriction violation order. Now, three type of protective orders here in Minnesota. There's an OFP, an order for protection. There's a danko, and there's a temporary restraining order, harassment restraining order.
But aren't we requiring the witness to have a certain legal knowledge to have the terminology right? I mean, she's using her best.
We're not, because, you know, the prosecutor could have further clarified, right? Further clarified for the court, but it didn't. And so what we're left with is this uncertainty as to, may I finish?
Yeah, please do.
This uncertainty as to what she is referring to when she is identifying this order that doesn't exist in Minnesota. And so for all these reasons, I'd ask either that this court reverse and vacate my client's conviction or reverse for a new trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And then counsel for respondent, we'll get the clock reset here. Thank you very much. Yeah, we can just go ahead and start it.
I'm just going to start and we'll stop at 52 seconds. Maybe. Oh.
There we go. All right. Counsel, when you're ready, please state your name for the record and you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this appeal. Appellant raises two issues on appeal. First, he argues that the evidence is insufficient to prove that the pretrial danko was still in force at the time he contacted the victim. But because the district court, one, received a copy of the pretrial danko, which said it was effective until the disposition of the underlying criminal case or until further order or modification, and two, received no evidence that the underlying criminal case was resolved or any order modifying or canceling the danko, and three, heard the victim's testimony that she called the police after appellant contacted her because he had a restriction violation order, the evidence viewed in a light most favorable to the verdict, as this court must, is sufficient to prove the danko was in force at the time appellant contacted the victim.
What evidence is there, direct evidence is there, that the danko was still in effect?
So first of all, there's the danko itself, which says that it's in effect until final disposition of the case and is ordered and or until there's further order or modification. And there is no evidence. There's no order introduced modifying it or disposing of the case.
Is that not an element of proof that the state has to make?
That it is in effect is certainly an element of proof that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The second piece of evidence is the victim's testimony that she contacted the police because there was a restriction violation order.
Would you agree that there was no evidence that the case had not been disposed of other than her comment, her testimony?
Yes, I would agree. I would agree with that.
So we're relying on what she said as the proof that it's still in effect.
we're relying on a combination of things, what she said and the Danko, the pretrial Danko as itself, and looking at the evidence as a whole. The only question is whether, based on that, the trial court could reasonably conclude that the element was proven. That's the standard of review, is based on the evidence available to the finder of fact, viewed in a light most favorable to the verdict, could a reasonable fact finder conclude based on that, that with due regard for the burden of proof, that the state had proved that element. I submit when you properly review that evidence in light of the applicable standard of review, that it was sufficient to meet that requirement. This isn't like those cases, for example, where there's a temporary ex parte harassment restraining order that by operation of law expires at the date of a final hearing or something like that. That's not the case here. The case here is that the order is effective until something else happens. I mean, essentially, it's a little bit like asking the state to prove a negative, because you don't have an order to submit showing that the case hasn't been disposed of. You don't have an order to submit into evidence showing that the Danko wasn't modified or canceled. In the absence of those things, the Danko is effective. And that's what the record shows here, especially when combined with the victim's testimony. And again, the victim's testimony, certainly it could have been clearer, and it'd be a much better case for me to argue. We probably wouldn't even be having this conversation if the victim's testimony were clearer. But what the standard of review doesn't require is absolute clarity in the testimony of witnesses, especially here where, as the court pointed out, we have a non-legal technician testifying about the order. The only reasonable referent to her testimony about a restriction violation order was the Danko she talked about earlier in her testimony. Reading that testimony any other way is putting on a different set of glasses, other than the light most favorable to the verdict glasses that the standard of review requires this court to use.
The Danko here was issued 4 months earlier.
That's correct.
What if we change the facts and say exact same facts, but the Danko was issued in 2015?
Again, if you have testimony from the victim that there that supports the conclusion that there was an order in place on the date of the offense, I think under the standard of review, that might be a closer call. But again, under the standard of review, close calls go to the verdict.
But the state still wouldn't have to prove there that that order is still in effect. Just the witness saying, "I have a restrictive order."
Well, I disagree with the premise of the question, because the state has to prove that the order was in effect. That there's no dictated way that it has to prove that. It can marshal all sorts of different evidence. Would a better case be to put in the register of actions, maybe, for the underlying criminal case that shows that it wasn't disposed of? Perhaps. That could possibly raise its own evidentiary issues and complicate things, but the state doesn't have to use any particular evidence to prove the existence of the order. So I think in the absence of anything else that would make the conclusion unreasonable for the finder of fact, that same evidence in a substantial passage of time would support a finding. There can be all sorts of reasons why a criminal case hasn't been resolved in numerous years, as the court's well aware. There could be warrants. There could be an intervening pandemic. Those sorts of things.
Was there an omnibus hearing in this case before?
I don't recall.
I
happen to have the register of actions up, so I.
What I'm wondering is, I can look. If there was an omnibus, is this an affirmative defense that had to be raised by the defense that it wasn't in effect?
I hadn't thought about whether it was an affirmative defense. I don't think it is. I don't think it's an affirmative defense that has to be raised by the defendant, because the existence of the order is an element of the offense that the state has to prove. Moving to the appellant's second argument that he's entitled to a new trial because the judge at a minimum created the appearance of bias when she relied on facts not introduced at the trial in her findings of fact, that argument fails because the record contains no evidence to support appellant's key assumption that the judge conducted an independent investigation outside the record instead of relying on her general knowledge. And for that reason alone, appellant has failed to demonstrate emergent bias. I disagree with appellant's counsel's reading of Dorsey and Lopez, that the mere fact alone that the trier of fact relied on extra record evidence transforms them into a partial finder of fact. And in fact, in Lopez, the Supreme Court specifically rejected that proposition. The Supreme Court said, the Supreme Court said that not all violations of that duty, the duty to decide a case based on the evidence presented at trial, transform an impartial trier of fact into a partial trier of fact. And that's Lopez at 117 to 118. And the Lopez court, as it read Dorsey, focused on the key being the independent investigation that was undertaken in Dorsey. That was what transformed the district court judge from an impartial finder of fact to a partial finder of fact there. And there's no record here that there was an independent investigation conducted by the district court. The appellant argues that it's safe to assume that there was, but that assumption is unsafe for three reasons. The first reason is that as a matter of statute, the statute authorizing the issuance of bancos provides for them to be issued after, in a separate hearing held after hearings where pretrial release issues are addressed.
But I think appellant's counsel's argument is that there was no evidence presented in this trial about the bail hearing or the Danko being explained to the defendant. And that's where it's a problem, that the trier of fact is supposed to rely on only the evidence that gets submitted. And there is nothing in this record about any of that.
And I agree with that. I said as much in my brief that it certainly the district court should not have relied on extra record evidence, whether it was the source of her memory of having presided over the bail hearing and issuing the Danko, or if there was evidence that it was this result of an independent investigation. That fact alone, yeah, I agree that that's not, the district court is not supposed to do that. That's a departure from the appropriate role. But Dorsey, as read by Lopez, doesn't say that every violation of that duty by itself transforms the finder of fact into a partial finder of fact. There's got to be something more than just the use of extra record evidence. And Lopez, I submit, reads Dorsey as saying essentially the linchpin of the holding there, the emergent bias holding and the emergent bias analysis, is the independent investigation. And here there is no evidence of independent investigation. There's simply an assumption by appellant of an independent investigation. But assumptions on appeal are never safe because the appellant has the duty to prove, not assume, error. And the third reason is that we presume on appeal that the district court properly discharged its duty. So it's one thing to, I acknowledge that the district court relying on extra record evidence, where whatever the source, was improper in that aspect. But that doesn't warrant the further assumption by itself that she conducted an independent investigation into the facts. That's simply not a safe assumption, and the burden is on the appellant to prove the facts he needs for relief.
So your argument is that emergent bias can only apply if there's an independent investigation.
I don't know that I would go quite that far, but I think that Lopez reads Dorsey as saying that independent investigation in Dorsey was the linchpin of the conclusion that there was emergent bias. And Lopez says that not every violation of the duty to set aside extra record knowledge in making findings of fact transforms the district court from an impartial finder of fact to a partial finder of fact. So when you read Dorsey and Lopez together, what you can discern is that to get to the concept, to get to a holding that the district court demonstrated emergent bias, there has to be something more than the mere consideration of extra record evidence.
What about saying the terms of the Danko were explained to him?
Again, I think both of those things evidence the fact that the district court considered extra record evidence in reaching the finding of fact. But that's, as I read the cases, and I think Lopez is pretty clear on this, that fact alone, that the district court considered extra record evidence in making the findings of fact, isn't enough to demonstrate emergent bias. There has to be something more.
But it's the question of whether the Danko existed and whether he was issued a Danko at the bail hearing. It seems to me it goes beyond that by saying not only that, he was explained the terms of this Danko. So not only did he have it, but he knew exactly what the terms are because I told him.
And that may be. I don't know that, but I would submit that the record is still sufficient to support the finding. I know the question of prejudice isn't part of the emergent bias analysis, but I'm trying not to talk past Judge Schmidt. I think we're not quite seeing eye to eye on the question of what constitutes relying on extra record evidence. I feel like you're saying that there was so much reliance on extra record evidence that that's enough to demonstrate emergent bias. I don't know if that's the thrust of the question. I think in light of Lopez, you've got to look at something more beyond consideration of extra record evidence. I submit that consideration of extra record evidence is all that finding of fact demonstrates. It doesn't just demonstrate the something more that appellant has to point to and prove to entitle him to relief on appeal. It's not the state or the respondent's burden to demonstrate that there wasn't emergent bias. That's the appellant's burden on appeal to demonstrate. And the only thing appellant has pointed to is the consideration of extra record evidence and the suggestion that we can assume an independent investigation. I submit that assumption is completely improper. It's completely unfounded by the record. And it completely ignores the principles of appellate review, as well as the presumptions we apply to district court conduct.
So you're saying that we can just disregard the extra extraneous comments from the court and still find it to be supported?
Well, yes, if we get to the question of the appearance of bias, the second type of bias that appellant has argued, yes. My argument is that there is no, that the appellant can't point to anything beyond the extra record consideration of evidence to demonstrate emergent bias, and that Lopez clearly says it's not enough to just point to extra record consideration of evidence to make a demonstration of emergent bias. I mean, that was exactly the situation in Lopez. The district court judge was relying on his general knowledge in making a finding of fact, and the Supreme Court concluded that that wasn't emergent bias. So what they're clearly saying is it's not enough to point out that a district court considered extra record evidence to demonstrate emergent bias, but that's all appellant here is pointing to in light of the fact that he hasn't pointed to anything else. He hasn't made out an emergent bias claim. I see my time is expiring. For all the reasons I've discussed here today and all the reasons set forth in my brief, I would ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel, we're getting the clock set up for you.
Stuck on 52, isn't it?
We can just set it there again, too.
I can just stop at 52, too.
There you go.
And maybe you should get the extra 52 seconds. I think I took mine.
That's fine. I've spoken enough. So I have a lot of points, but I'm going to try to prioritize them in the order of importance I see. The first thing about my the language that I use about safe to assume, that was probably a little too imprecise to reflect what Lopez actually requires, which is a reasonable inference, right, from the record, to show that there was an investigation. Now, we're not conceding that investigation is necessary. Lopez is clearly distinguishable because that is a case about knowledge that the district court judge gleaned from being out in the world in a time of COVID to undermine credibility of the defendant. Whereas ours is a case where the court, much like in Dorsey, gleaned that information from in their role as a judge and used it to find that somebody was, that my client was guilty of the offense, right? Rather than just undermining credibility, I would argue that, I would submit that diluting the state's burden of proof is far worse than simply just undermining a piece of defendant's case. Now, as far as whether or not there's evidence to show a reasonable inference that there was an investigation here, this notion that we only point to the fact of the use of the information is inaccurate, right? We also point to the amount of time that has passed since the issuance of the Danko and the time of my client's trial and the time when the district court rendered its verdict, right? District courts do all variety of things over the course of their duties. They probably issue a lot of Dankos. They see a lot of cases. It's reasonable to assume, reasonable to infer at the very least, that given in a year and a month had passed between the time that the district court issued that Danko and explained the terms on the record to my client, that the district court had forgotten that fact and needed to look into that other file to confirm that, yes, in fact, I had issued that Danko at a bail hearing, and I had explained the terms of that Danko to the defendant in this case.
But it would also be reasonable to assume that this is a judge who's a lot smarter than me and can have that recall of what happened.
Well, I would never assume that, Your Honor, first and foremost, but it may be reasonable to infer that, but it does not disqualify our inference, right? And all Lopez requires is that reasonable inference. If you look at Lopez clearly, what it provides is that there's not sufficient evidence of an investigation because there's nothing from the record to even reasonably infer that there was an investigation done. And so that is a very low standard. And I would submit that given the time frame that had passed between when the Danko was issued and when the trial took place and when the verdict was rendered, that there's a reasonable inference that the district court had to look into that other file to confirm that information outside of the record that it used to prove to determine that my client was guilty. Now, I want to sort of flip back to the first argument in my brief about sufficiency. I think that the key piece that the state misses in its discussion about the standard of proof is that beyond a reasonable doubt piece, right? The court needed to find, and the state needed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the Danko existed at the time my client had contact with the complainant. And so I would ask that the court consider it in that lens. And there are just simply too many assumptions that the state is asking this court to make in order to determine that that element had been proven for there to be a sufficient showing of beyond a reasonable doubt. The state asks this court to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. It is correct that under the direct evidence standard, that is the correct standard to apply. But it's not applied in the way that the state's asking to. We look at each individual piece of evidence and we determine what we can glean from that evidence when looking at it in the light most favorable to the verdict. That the Danko was issued, there's no conflicting evidence. 4 months before the contact shows that it was issued 4 months before the contact. There's nobody is arguing that it wasn't issued. That the complainant testified that there was a restriction violation order, that there was some sort of order restricting contact, that is also not being contested here, right? And that is all you can glean from that. So I see that my time is up. I would just submit that the two pieces of evidence that the state relies on does not meet that beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today. We will submit an opinion within the statutory time frame. And thank you both, counsel, for joining us in New Ulm. I know this is outside of the normal travel for both of you, but the court appreciates it. We're going to take a short recess to go gather our other guests, and we will be momentarily.